Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Little and Missing Link. So starting off with Little, what did you think of that movie, Mike?
It's a genre that almost always works. And I don't mean this in a crass way, but it's the body switch comedy, whether it's Big or Freaky Friday. There's something that's so visual, obviously, about that, and so funny because you have, you know, somebody little becoming somebody big or vice versa. You have people switching genders, whatever the case might be. And then because that's the basic setup, the thing is, then it's just fun to watch if you have appealing actors. And actually, we do in Little. I mean, there's some good performances here. So however silly the story might be, and borderline stupid at times, right? I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the film, but sometimes it's like really like, oh, my God, that's dumb. There's some of that. But when you care about the actor, as in the performance, and then you care about the general situation in terms of the metaphysics of it. And I always say in a case like this, you can't worry too much about the metaphysics. Because if you really get sternly logical, there's like, oh, no, wait a minute. How would this work exactly in terms of laws of physics and whatever? You just got to go with it. And then once you have that as the premise, then what you should care about, what you should worry about is how well it follows through and how consistently it follows through. And I think here with Little, it's very inconsistent in a lot of ways, but I'm always watching for that. Okay, give me that ridiculous premise, and then what are you going to do with it?
You know, I saw the preview for this movie, I don't know how many times, because I think they really pushed it. You know, it seemed like they were really trying to make sure people knew it was coming out. So, I mean, I laughed every single time. So I knew going in, you know, pretty much what I was going to get and was not disappointed.
Well, we should probably tell people what it's about.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, it's about a nasty boss who's mean to everybody. And one day, a young girl puts a curse on her to make her little so that she could cut her down to her own size and ostensibly be able to confront her. Because they would both be the same size. So the woman wakes up the next day and she's little.
Now, adding some demographic data to that, the woman we're talking about is she's 38, so she's still young, but not that young. She's the CEO of an Atlanta tech company, and I mention that for a few reasons. The fact that almost all American movies are made in Georgia these days. So I was in Atlanta the other week, and that's the place.
Hotlanta.
Hotlanta. I was there. It's the place to be. And the thing is that the fact that it's an African-American woman running the company, she's very accomplished, but she's also very driven. And you could say that's just simply that's her type A personality. You could also say she's proving herself. So there's that as one thing to consider within the film, though the film itself doesn't really to any great extent consider that. But the thing it does consider is the fact that when somebody is so driven in adulthood or, you know, on the verge of middle agehood, what are the underpinnings for it psychologically? What's the armchair psychoanalysis here? Well, namely that she, like so many of us or all of us, was a middle school nerd. And many people never recover from that condition, right? And in her case, she's been reacting against that. So the premise of this body switch film is that this highly motivated, really ambitious, verging on repulsively aggressive woman. She's really mean to everybody.
She's
really horrible. But the fact that we're meant to feel sorry for her because, after all, she was teased. She was picked on for being an accomplished schoolgirl. And now she's overcompensated. So the body switch thing is, what if she suddenly had a spell cast on her, as she does, and she finds out that she's, you know, back in a really small body and being sent back to middle school? What makes it work, more or less, again, is the acting. Regina Hall is really good as Jordan Saunders. That's the name of the Atlanta CEO of the tech company. And Marseille Martin is really good as the 13-year-old girl that, you know, she becomes in a way. And even when many aspects of the script bothered me or I was just sort of so-so about them, you get those performances. And I would add a third performance, Issa Rae as the office assistant, April, who's really at the receiving end of so much of that terrible CEO behavior. You have those three performances, and even though the script, I think, is very uneven and it's really not as funny as it should be, I mean, my basic feeling was this was a film that should have been either more serious or sillier. It takes a kind of safe, middle-of-the-road approach to it. If you're going to do it seriously, there's a lot of material to work with, right? If you're going to do it in a silly way, my God, you could go to town with it, right? This one has some of that, but it just sort of takes this middle course. It's always like, you know, what's the safest way to tell this story? And so for me, it held my interest, and I laughed a few times, but it's not a particularly memorable film.
I was enjoying watching it for the contrast with Big. Because in Big, you had a kid who, you know, he's not tall enough to ride the rides that he wants to ride. He's not old enough to do the things that he wants to do. And people usually remember when they were younger, wishing that they were old enough to be allowed into places that they wanted to go. This takes a different approach, which is that you become little instead of big, and you go back to all those insecurities like you mentioned. But you also then have to go back to that place. You have to go back to junior high school. So it's not like being able to be younger or to be as young as this character actually goes and then show up at work and everybody being amazed that you are as smart as you are because you're really not 12 or whatever she's supposed to be.
Well, yeah, the most effective scenes are the ones where she really does go back to middle school. Mm-hmm. And there's that perpetual, that eternal middle school cafeteria scene. And nothing ever changes in that respect. I don't care if it's the actual middle school cafeteria or the equivalent in the corporate world as to who's sitting at which table and what the pecking order is. And that's kind of excruciating in a sort of uncomfortably funny way at times, because you realize the extent to which she's picked on and that, you know, life is miserable for her. And it helps to explain, not to justify, but to help explain why as a CEO she's so driven. She's so determined to show that she's prettier, better dressed, you know, more financially successful, more ambitious than anyone else, because she's going to get back. This is her payback.
It is her payback. The sad thing is that most people think, oh, if I could go back knowing what I know now. But she's still stuck in not liking who she was as a middle schooler. But it would have been interesting for her to go back with the same bad hair and the same bad clothes, but with the confidence that she has as an older person to make it work. That would have been a completely different take, and that would have been an interesting twist.
That would have been a more potentially serious twist. Again, this is a film that goes right down the middle, and so it's audience friendly that way, but it could have been a little edgier, either at the edge of being like a serious examination of this woman's psychological makeup, or at the silly end, it could have gone into all-out surrealism in some ways, right? It could have been so goofy, so out there. And there's some of that in the film, but it pretty much just hews to the middle.
I thought it was a nice small role for Justin Hartley as the teacher, who's named Gary Marshall, which I thought was a definite reference to Penny Marshall, Gary's sister,
sure,
who directed Big.
Sure, absolutely. I love in one of the reviews of the film, Justin Hartley, who plays that role, he's referred to as, quote, the hot eighth grade teacher, close quote. I kept that in quotation marks. But that's another example of how this film plays it down the middle, because imagine what it's like to be in that classroom, and he's the very friendly, very effective teacher. But meantime, this little girl, this kind of creepy little girl at this point, right? She's sort of, you know, seducing him or
attempting to.
She's making eyes at him. And he, at one point, actually says, would you mind, like, looking away or not?
Look over there.
Look over there. Look over there. Don't look at me, kind of thing. And it's actually pretty funny there. But that's an example of how that works in one or two scenes. But think about the film re-envisioned, where it either took it to really serious ends or really silly ends. Here, it's more or less effective, but it just stays there. You know what I mean? It doesn't push further with that. Because that's really a kind of compelling scenario there as to, you know, what the teacher should make of this girl who's acting like a seductress suddenly in the classroom.
Yeah, but he plays the same guy he plays in This Is Us. You know, it's the same stock kind of character. The good-looking, affable, well-meaning dude.
Sure.
Regina Hall, I thought, was fantastic in this. And I just saw her in Support the Girls.
Support the Girls.
Yeah, she's always really strong in everything she's in.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, again, as I said earlier, it's the acting that ultimately carries what otherwise is a very uneven vehicle. And when I was mentioning over and over again that kind of right down the middle approach to it, one aspect of that should still be brought out is the fact that in this kind of body switching comedy in particular, you have to have life lessons learned. And they've got to be there, right? It's just the template for it. They're here, but they're built in such a way that they're like so predictable and so obvious that I felt like it was a kind of checklist of, okay, you've learned this, you've learned that. And by the end of the film, I just felt like it was kind of pro forma, that you need this scene, you need that one.
I wonder if the intended market was a lot more younger than we think, because Marseille Martin not only pitched the movie, but she was one of the executive producers. So I wonder how much of a hand she had in it as, look, this is for kids, you know, to see when you're older and you have to go back to where you were. It's still just as hard.
Well, the box office has been middling, and I can't break it down further in terms of who's going and who's not going. But I think one of the challenges here is, in the marketing, and having seen the trailer many, many times,
yes.
I wonder, well, who is this pitched at? Is it pitched at young executive women who, you know, had miserable middle school experiences to revisit that in a kind of nostalgic way, but horror nostalgia? Or is it pitched more at kids? You know, ideally, you'd want to get all those demographic groups, but I honestly don't know, like, who's actually going to go see it, or, you know, what audience it's really appealing to. And again, maybe that's something of a model, as maybe it's not sure itself exactly who the audience is for the film. Because it doesn't obviously pitch either, speaking of going down the middle, it doesn't obviously pitch to adults who want a serious consideration. It's an understatement to say that. But conversely, it's not really going all the way the other side, which could have been really goofy and silly, which would be for small kids to laugh at. It's somewhere in the middle, and mm-hmm. maybe that's not such a great place to be.
Well, in Big, the change happened with that machine at the carnival, Mr. Majestic or whatever it was, who he makes a wish, and then he has to try to find that machine to undo the curse or the miracle, however you want to phrase it, however you want to look at it. Where in this, what was missing, I thought, is that as a grown person, she upsets this young girl who puts a curse on her. And the young girl says, you know, I wish you were little, because then I'd check you, boo. And there's never a scene where there is that showdown between the younger version of the woman she turned little and that girl. They do meet up. She does the curse, but there's no checking of Boo. And that's a missing scene, because the younger version of herself had things to share. And the girl who wanted to fight her or straighten her out never really got to have that conversation with her to realize the young girl in the big body and the reverse.
Well, again, that's a part of that down-the-middle approach that I've been castigating here, namely that girl who casts the spell. She's only in a few scenes. She doesn't have more than a few minutes on screen. And so you could have taken it either in a more serious way, like, well, what are her issues and how does she fight? And by the way, where'd she learn these great nifty magic tricks? Mm-hmm. Or you could have taken it the other direction, which would be a silly comedy for small kids, as in she could zap all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Imagine what she could do with those powers.
Right.
But in the film, it's just largely unexplained. It's that kind of given where it's like, okay, I guess I accept that as the reason for what's happened. But then when she finally pops up near the end just to help set things right, it's like she's been yanked out of the wings. You know, like, we got to bring her back in, and you don't get what you were asking for quite rightly, which would be those missing scenes that would take it in some direction, would do something with it. So she remains a rather enigmatic character in a lot of ways, barely a character, really.
There's a few scenes where, you know, the boyfriend shows up and does like a striptease kind of thing. You don't see anything. But do you think that made the movie too sexy for it to be a kids' movie? I can't remember. Is it PG? I don't even know what it's rated.
Yeah, it's PG-13. And so that's what I was getting at earlier, is that, you know, does it really know the audience it's going for? Because some of it is so juvenile that literally, right, it's meant for kids in middle school, if you will. But then there's that scene when that boyfriend comes over. I think, okay, you know, but it doesn't take much for him to, like, be, you know, taking the clothes off and lounging around the apartment all in a way that, you know, for an adult viewer, you'd say, well, fine, you know, eye candy, whatever. But if you had a small kid with you, I mean, I don't think, like, let's say if you were a parent of a child in middle school, would you feel comfortable taking your child to that? The child might be happy to go in mm-hmm. a way, but as a parent, would you feel like, well, you know, this is like a little risque, or a little, we have to have a conversation during the long drive home or something. It's kind of awkward, don't you think? Because of several of those scenes, it never slips into R-rated material at all. It's
right.
Very careful. But it's what I call borderline. Because those bedroom scenes there with mm-hmm. the guy who's, you know, extremely buff and not shy about taking clothes off, and he's lounging around. I think this is not quite a kiddie comedy at this point.
No. And actually, another thing that it missed the mark of doing, which would have been a really funny and appropriate scene, is when you are in middle school, you know, there's no way you wouldn't be interested in all those clothes that the older version of yourself had. So yes, the coworker who ends up pretending to be the aunt or whatever, the adult in charge, the guardian, she kind of adopts the wardrobe and everything. And she makes the young girl wear, you know, ugly clothes from Target or whatever it is. But, you know, in any real story, that young girl would have been in mom's closet. She would have walked out the door in the ugly Target outfit and then put on the hoochie outfit in the bathroom. That's what would have really happened. And they were her clothes anyway, so.
We just lost Target as a corporate sponsor. Oh, well.
Well, you know, clothing's very, very important in middle school.
Oh, it's an obsession for girls that age. Yeah, and that's a missed opportunity in the film. You're right. It needed to do more with that.
It did. It did. There was an element of knowing what you know, and also that not just being confidence, but makeup and clothing and all of those kinds of things that she figured out as an adult. She still had all that knowledge. You know, she could have rocked that crazy hair.
So I think what happens here is when they have that body switch premise, they're coasting with it and they're not really digging deeper. And by digging deeper, it doesn't have to be the serious end. It could be the silly end, but somehow to do more with the clothes, for instance. That would, it would have been so much fun to have a montage of her with various outfits.
Yes.
I usually don't like that kind of montage because it's so glib and obligatory, but here it would have been welcome, to have her go through these costume changes.
Yes, and it's also a stock scene.
Because you're trying, chick flick stock scene, but you're trying on identities, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Put on the outfits.
That was the missing part, was the reveling in that identity.
So that was the missing link in it?
That was the missing link. Is that our segue?
If you like it.
Well, Missing Link is a Leica movie, the latest one. And this is the first one, I think, that they did that's actually for adults. Speaking of whether the movie is meant for adults or kids. Certainly, the story is something that can be watched by children, but it has an all-adult cast and lots of famous people.
Yeah, famous voices, if you will. That's always an awkward thing to talk about in animated films, the extent to which it matters. Because I've seen some like really mediocre animated films over the years, but they had a great vocal cast. And sometimes you recognize the voice, sometimes you don't, but ultimately it doesn't matter, you know, with what you're watching. Here, I don't think it matters a whole lot, but you have some really gifted vocal talent, and we will talk about them. But as to who it's intended for, who's the audience, it sounds kind of Weasley to say this, but I mean, this really is a film, I think, for parents with young children.
Yes.
Because there are some aspects of it where an adult viewer would certainly appreciate it, either on the technical level of the animation or the character dynamics or any interest you might have in exotic places and species and all of that. But there are other things there, in fact, the bulk of it, that's just so kind of goofy that you could be a small kid and just go to giggle, which is fine. I mean, you know, you pay as you go. I mean, it's fine to sit and laugh at it. So let's dissect it.
Well, you know, interestingly, this was the movie that I saw and I had the entire theater to myself. But I didn't see it the first weekend it came out or anything. I saw it like midweek. And I think all the people who had wanted to see it had already seen it. So I had the place to myself, which means, you know, you can laugh as loud as you want. You can just notice more things because there's nobody talking. And I was really struck by the technical aspects of it. I almost didn't care what the story was. I was so impressed with the level of detail that they put into each of these characters, right down to like the tiny little buttons on the clothes.
And, you know, even though it was sort of lukewarm vis-a-vis the story, per se, and the characterizations, it's a well-animated, it's a nicely animated film. And one thing that struck me, as with you, is the detail. And detail matters so much. And let me slow down there and talk a bit about that animation. The fact that it makes use of stop-motion animation, it's kind of old-fashioned with the way it's done. And the storyline, the setting, follows through on that very, very effectively. For instance, that stop-motion animation already takes us back to earlier styles, earlier films. So here we have a story that goes to multiple exotic locations, but what it's also doing is revisiting earlier periods, the look of earlier periods. It's drawing from Victorian literature. It has that look to it, storybook kind of appearance that way. There's a segment which is drawn on our Western frontier, the American West, so it's kind of late 19th century ambiance that way. And then in terms of, you know, traveling as it does, we end up, in effect, with a 1930s-style Shangri-La up in the Himalayas, which is something that, you know, Frank Capra would have recognized, I suppose, from Lost Horizon. Because the story, as such, is a journey film. I mean, you're searching for creatures like yourself, or just searching for exotic creatures. So it opens, actually, with Sir Lionel Frost. That's the character voiced by Hugh Jackman, who's a member of a Geographic Society with a lot of infighting in it. This is worse than the NRA. There's a lot of internal fighting here. And he initially in the film, the very beginning of it, is you know, looking for and finding Loch Ness Monster. So that's a good way to open. And then he's going to, you know, head from there to Washington State, and then from there to the Himalayas. So why do I mention that? Well, Because along the way in that journey, the geography changes so much that the opportunities for animation are quite welcome. And then secondly, in a stop-motion animated film that's innately, intrinsically nostalgic, you're going to have the looks that I've described there in terms of, you know, Victorian culture, the Wild West, Shangri-La, storybook material that way. So there are a lot of visual opportunities here. And the film has a nice, terse 95-minute running time, so it doesn't dawdle for too long. It takes you to some other place. And you would have actually enjoyed being one of the animators because suddenly, you know, the palette will change or your designs will change to adjust to that new environment.
Well, like Little, it's about finding where you belong and to find, you know, your group of people or the people that appreciate what you have to offer.
So tell us about Mr. Link.
Well, you know, the interesting thing I thought about the character is, first of all, he looks like a meatball that's been rolled around in some...
But he's 8 feet tall.
Right, in some fall leaves. But he's a Bigfoot, and he has decided, you know what, maybe if we can go find those abominable snowmen, maybe, you know, they're distant relatives of mine. And actually, that was one of the scenes that I thought was the funniest, was they're completely not welcome. They're considered interlopers or spies or something, so they imprison them. And when they finally find a way to escape, you hear, I think it's Emma Thompson as the person say, "The people we don't want here are escaping."
She's very good there because she's quite literally imperial. She is the Himalayan queen.
Yes.
So once you get to the Shangri-La kingdom, and again, I like that aspect of the storyline because it does dovetail with our own quest for identity. Oftentimes, when you feel like you're the only one, you know, in terms of missing Link, you're the only Bigfoot and you're lonely, you want to find your people, your family, if you will. You assume that if you somehow return to the mother country, mm-hmm. some other continent, some other place, that you'll be welcome with open arms. But then when you get there, you find out that they look on you as a stranger.
Right.
You're not one of them, really. I mean, there's some physical resemblance, but you are the outsider. So when he finally gets to the Himalayas there, that the queen of this particular kingdom, voiced by Emma Thompson, will be really severe and quite literally lock them up, you mm-hmm. know. And I like that. That's one of the things about the film that I think could appeal to any viewer, but I think that's where adult viewers in particular will realize that, you know, when you're looking to find your place, don't assume that just because you go someplace else and you find people who look like you more or less and where you may have come from or you might have had some, you know, DNA kinship with, you know, generations back, you can't assume that you're going to be welcome with open arms because they have their own society. Mm-hmm. You're the tourist. You're the invader in some ways. What are you doing here? You're not one of us, really.
Right. You're the other.
You're the other.
Yeah. And I think that kind of the reason I thought it paired well with Little is because that's middle school in a nutshell right there. Everybody feels like they're the Bigfoot. Even if every single person there is Bigfoot, you're still the weirdest one. I think that feeling kind of comes across. And, you know, the character himself is so likable. It's also one of those things where you think, well, who wouldn't like you?
Well, the actor has a lot to do with that,
yeah.
Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's supposed to be, you know, he's supposed to be likable. You are supposed to think, you know, why would you have trouble fitting
Zach
in?
Well, Zach Galifianakis, there's a kind of goofball likability mm-hmm. there that he's like, oh, you'd want to pal around or hang out or just lift. He's such a well-intentioned, nice guy, if you will. And so even though, like, to an outsider looking at him, it's a monster, really. I mean, you know, 8 feet tall and, you know, and very big feet and all those things there. He's never frightening at all. It's that kind. And again, that's one of the cuddly aspects of it that would be appealing, I think, to small kids. It's like the monster as a stuffed animal, practically.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Monster as stuffed animal. That's a great way of putting it.
And I think, actually, that's a very viewer-friendly thing. So I think it's a really, I mean, I enjoyed the film. I wasn't crazy about it, but I enjoyed it for the animation and for the essential likability of those central characters. And I felt like, I mean, I was just watching it as a viewer, but if you were a viewer with a small child attached, I thought it'd be a good parent and child thing.
Some of the jokes are pitched towards the adults. But a lot of them are really just, you know, standard kid jokes.
Yeah, and it's done middling business, so it's not really like much at the box office. But it seems to me, and since we talk a lot about ancillary and streaming and all that, it's the kind of film that will have what I used to call shelf life. In mm-hmm. other words, that even though first run in movie theaters, it hasn't done a whole lot. People who do see it are inclined to like it, I should assume. And it seems to me that it's the sort of thing like, well, a few months from now, when people are looking for another film to watch with the kids, that's the kind. Don't you think it's the kind of thing that people would be streaming?
I do think, though, that when it was released, it really didn't get a lot of good times for the show.
Oh.
You know, you can usually tell the early matinees are obviously trying to get all the kids.
Right.
But, you know, just the number of shows they had for the 3D, mm-hmm. there was like a 3 o'clock and an 8 p.m.
I noticed that, yeah.
And I wondered what that was about because, you know, that what you really want to appreciate here is the technical marvels of Leica, you know, the things that they do, the care that they take. You can tell that these are like real clothes that they put on the models. And, you know, just the fun of, you know, playing with miniatures.
I think you're pointing to a larger quandary, actually, which has to do with 3D. When the 3D phenomenon, you know, revived, it was in a more lasting way than the early 50s, for sure. And people thought it's here to stay now. And it kind of sort of is here to stay. And yet audience interest in it has tapered off the last couple years. One reason has to do with the craven nature of theater exhibitors, how much they were charging per ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And NF film producers, in terms of some of the movies released in 3D that I didn't want to see in any dimension, whether 2 or 3 or whatever. And so my feeling there was that audiences were getting turned off because they felt like they were being suckered. They were, you know, forking out a lot of money to see a movie that wasn't worth seeing at all, much less in 3D. And some movies, even that if they're worthwhile, they're not essential. It's not Avatar-type viewing where you really prefer the 3D. So what's happened in the past year to two is that even though films like Avengers, for that matter, and certainly like Missing Link, have that 3D option, theaters themselves are not having as many daily screenings in 3D. They're mostly standard. It might be a larger image, those options, which are numerous now, but only one or two screenings per day in 3D. And I think they're still sort of finding their way as to, well, to what extent is there still a public for 3D? And if so, and there is still to some extent, how many times a day do you want to show it? Or is it more advantageous to show it in a standard flat format? So what you'll get sometimes, and I've noticed this, I usually avoid most 3D screenings if I can, but what I've noticed just from the show times is really awkward, really odd times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you could see it in 3D at 10 o'clock in the morning or at, you know, 10:30 at night.
And those are your only two choices.
Yeah, those would be like the only choices. And I'm thinking, well, either A, it doesn't work for me, or B, like what audience are they really looking for? I mean, how many people are going to go to see this animated film primarily designed for kids, push come to shove, but they're going to go to like a 10:30 p.m. screening in 3D.
Right. If it's supposed to be for kids, you're really not going to get them at 10.
You're not going to get them at that late hour anyway. But in terms of 3D, with you know, the added ticket costs and all that, are you really going to capture an audience there? So I think they're frankly not entirely sure how they want to handle that. That may explain what you found.
I'm a big fan of 3D, and I thought they did a great job with Dumbo. They actually made sure that some of the scenes were better in 3D, and some stuff has been incredible in 3D. The Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey was awesome in 3D. Even Puss in Boots was good in 3D. What did you think about Zoe Saldana's character? Did you think, like I did, oh, Frida Kahlo?
Yeah, she was definitely made up to look that way. It was sort of the unibrowed wonder, yeah.
The attitude.
Yeah. And then the attitude as well. I don't know. I just thought it was kind of marginal to the overall story. She was there, but to me, it honestly isn't at the core of what's going on here, which has more to do with the abominable whatever he is,
yes.
You know, looking for his family, looking for himself, and of course the English scientist who takes the interest and so on. And to me, then, the character Zoe Saldana plays, Adelina of Fortnite, seems somewhat ancillary to all that. You know what I mean? Not quite off to the side, but in many scenes, sort of off to the side.
But the stock, feisty girl character.
Yeah. Central casting kind of thing, and not really that important. I mean, imagine it this way. What if she just had dropped out of the story completely? I don't think it would have hurt the story, frankly.
It really wouldn't have. No, it just gave you another character to follow, you know, on the journey.
Well, and that's because so many movies and these animated films in particular are always busy. God forbid you should ever linger and pause over a beautiful bit of animation or anything. They keep going, right? It's sort of the roadrunner mentality. They just keep going, keep moving. And so toss in another character, because I don't think she really adds that much to the story, but it's incidental pleasure. Here's a new character. She's going to bounce around a bit. And for art historians in the audience, they'll think, oh, there's Frida Kahlo.
Yeah. I did think one last thing about the animation was the nose on the main character. I could not stop looking at it because it looked like wax or even like a popsicle. It had this perfect blended color to it. and a real translucency. I marveled at all the animation that they did in this.
But that was a really tightly focused bit of viewership. I mean,
check out the nose when you go see this movie. That's my final word. What's yours, Mike?
Look at the rest of the face, too. I mean, but, joking aside, it's a film worth seeing, I would think, particularly for parents with small kids. I mean, there's enough to hold you there. And some of it is scientific interest. What are these strange creatures? Where do they live? I mean, it's an educational opportunity of sorts as well.
And if you don't see it in the theaters, definitely check it out on DVD, especially if they include any behind-the-scenes stuff.
Absolutely.
And that takes care of this week, so we will see you next week.
All right, take care.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.